More than anything, we need to change the poisonous atmosphere in Washington. You know, we have strong disagreements, but we need to stop seeing each other as enemies. We need to talk to one another, listen to one another, work with one another, and we can do that.
President Biden echoing the sentiment of President Lincoln's first inaugural address in remarks yesterday, his first public comments since the historic ouster of a sitting House Speaker in the middle of his term. The House is now at a standstill until at least the middle of next week when they are scheduled to elect a new Speaker. How that will play out is really anyone's guess. If January's 15-round vote to elect McCarthy as Speaker is any indication, that took days. But zooming out and looking at the big picture of, all of this, my next guest says this uncertainty and instability is a sign that our republic could be in peril. Daniel Ziblatt is a professor of government at Harvard University and co-author of the new book with Stephen Levitsky called Tyranny of the Minority: Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. Welcome back to Press Play.
Great to be with you, Madeline.
Great to have you. Your previous book with Stephen was How Democracies Die. Are you seeing that happening right now in the United States?
Yeah, you know, I don't think American democracy is dying, but it's certainly in a dangerous spot. I mean, we're rocked by lots of instability. You know, we think back to January 6th, 2021, where we had a difficult transition of power, an assault on the Congress. And then what we see today is kind of further signs of instability. And I think what's worrying is that instability does often precede democratic breakdown. You know, I'm not saying that American democracy is about to break down, but it's certainly not working the way that many of us expect.
Certainly not this week when we've seen what happened in the House. What is your take on that and how that all went down?
Yeah, I think it's really, you know, one thing to put it in context, you know, it's tempting to interpret it as just, you know, it's a really close Republican-Democratic margin. And so these small group of Republicans have a lot of clout within the Republican Party. But what's so striking is if you think back to Nancy Pelosi's speakership and when the Democrats were in control of the House just in the last Congress, their margin was even smaller. And yet Nancy Pelosi was able to hold the Democrats together. And the kind of the left wing of the Democratic Party played along with the party leadership. What's striking here is the complete fragmentation, despite the fact that the margins are actually bigger for the Republicans. And I think what this is the result of is a real radicalization of the Republican Party. I mean, the beating heart of the Republican Party is with those members of Congress who ousted McCarthy. And they also have the support of former President Trump. And all of this gives them outsized kind of influence, this radical wing of the Republican Party that's really makes things more difficult for our democracy.
So you're saying that the rot is really with the GOP when it comes to this threat to a democracy, that it is a party that is being held hostage by its most extreme element. Did that originate with Donald Trump, or did it originate earlier than that, do you think?
Yeah, so I think it did originate earlier than that. I mean, you know, it's true that former President Trump, while in office, made things worse, but he was the result of a long set of changes in our society and in the Republican Party. We trace these out in our book, Tyranny of the Minority, where the Republican Party has, went from the party of Lincoln. You mentioned Lincoln at the beginning, party that even in the 1960s was a party that was supporting civil rights and was really the engine and behind civil rights and voting rights legislation in large part, to today a party that's really gone off the rails. I mean, by all kind of international metrics, the Republican Party is much more similar to the Hungarian governing party or the Turkish governing party in terms of its commitment to liberal democratic norms. And so, you know, it's certainly not all Republicans are like this, but there's key elements within the party that are. I mean, in our book, we lay out three basic criteria. To be a party committed to democracy means you accept elections, win or lose. You don't use violence to gain and to hold on to power, and you don't use violent rhetoric. And then third, most critically, if you're a party committed to democracy, you have to distance yourself and elements within your party that embrace those two first criteria. And so what's so striking is the Republican Party increasingly fails all three of those metrics. And so that's what makes us worry.
Right. So I guess the question is, why is that? Because that hasn't really proved a winning formula to cater to the extreme element of the party. It certainly hasn't worked in the last several elections. Donald Trump has lost them. So why is it that the Republican Party can't seem to wean itself from its most fringy elements?
Yeah, that's really a great question because, you know, the genius of democracy, the genius of the American political system is that, you know, when a party loses what it's supposed to do, you know, like a firm, when it loses customers, it's supposed to go back to the drawing table, come up with a new strategy, come up with some new faces, come up with some new leadership. And usually this is what parties do. This is how democracy is supposed to work. Democracy is supposed to be kind of self-correcting. You know, think of the Democratic Party after a long period in the wilderness in the 1980s. Bill Clinton came back, you know, were new Democrats, a new ideology, a new new leadership. That the British Labour Party, after many years in the electoral wilderness during the 1980s, came back with Tony Blair, a new face, new ideology. This is how democracy is supposed to work. And what's so striking is the Republican Party is much slower to adapt. You know, the Republican Party didn't win the popular vote in 2016, won the Electoral College vote, didn't win the popular vote or the Electoral College vote in 2020. And in fact, the Republican Party has only won one popular vote for the presidency since 1988, and that's in 2004. And so it's not adapting. And we make the case in our book that really what's driving this, paradoxically, unintentionally, is our Constitution. There's key elements in our constitutional structure, including the Electoral College, including the Senate, allow parties to gain power without winning majorities. We're the only democracy in the world where this is the case. We're the only democracy in the world with an Electoral College. And because the party can gain power, that is, win the presidency without gaining majorities, it doubles down on its strategy of appealing to the base and not trying to reach out to more moderate voters. And so in this way, our institutions are kind of poisoning and thwarting the kind of normal self-correcting logic of democracy. And I think that's now plaguing the rest of the political system.
But that's not something that can be fixed except via a constitutional amendment.
Yeah, it's a big challenge for us. I mean, you know, I think we can, you know, the Democratic Party can win in the short run and, you know, can figure out ways of working around this. But I think we'll continue to be plagued by this kind of periodic crisis or sense that each national election is a national emergency until we begin to think about how to address some of these institutions. So, you know, we actually lay out 15 institutional proposals, some of which are big reaches. I mean, eliminating the Electoral College is a real challenge. There's been many efforts to do this constitutionally through the constitutional amendment process. The most recent effort was in 1970, which actually had the support of overwhelming majorities in the House, Democrats and Republicans. Richard Nixon supported abolishing the Electoral College, the Chamber of Commerce, the AFL-CIO, but it stumbled in the Senate. So, you know, there's more short-term steps that we can take to kind of begin to reform our institutions, including another kind of major barrier to majority rule is the filibuster in the Senate, which is not in the Constitution and is something that that the Senate itself could rule on to weaken or to at least to even possibly eliminate.
Except that any party in power does not want to get rid of that.
Yeah. So what's really interesting is that all of these institutions at different points in time have benefited Democrats, at other points in time have benefited Republicans. So it's really important to emphasize that the institutional reforms that are necessary to strengthen our democracy are not partisan. They're just often very unfair because there's really no justification for saying that the loser of the popular vote should win the presidency. So you know, the challenge is to kind of figure out how to implement these reforms. And there's actually a great American tradition of democratizing our Constitution. You know, go back to right after the founding, the Bill of Rights include a bunch of amendments. And at the beginning of the 20th century, women got the right to vote after many decades of struggle for this. We now elect our senators rather than appointing them after a couple of decades of struggle for this. And so, you know, there's a possibility to do this. And I think in many ways, one of the big barriers to this is that we've sort of lost the capacity to imagine that we can do this. And the challenge for political leaders, you know, under pressure from social movements, with citizens demanding that we carry out these institutional reforms, to kind of find workarounds, ways of carrying out the major kind of institutional reforms that our democracy needs.
Yeah. Well, how much of this is because we are an aging democracy and filled with aging and / old leaders? We are in a gerontocracy. So how is it that we can get these young people in positions of power who might have really interesting new ideas that could give a shot in the arm to our democracy?
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, these are two different features. I mean, so we have a very old constitution. We have the oldest written constitution in the world. It's designed in a pre-democratic era. And, you know, there's much to admire about our constitution. I mean, we all, you know, political leaders take loyalty oaths to the Constitution. It's important that we respect the Constitution. But part of the reason the Constitution has worked so well is that we've amended it. And there's a great tradition of this. And so, you know, there's another very old constitution that we describe in our book, the Norwegian Constitution, which actually turns out to be the second oldest written constitution in the world, 1814. It was highly undemocratic when it was initially written, but it's been amended hundreds of times. And so today, Norway is a very robust and vital democracy. So I think, you know, in fact, we can embrace this tradition and in a way we can try to work to improve our democracy. You know, the aging of our political leaders is also an interesting phenomenon. You know, I don't know if I have a really good explanation for why that's happening. It seems to be happening across lots of democracies. And I think there are a lot of factors driving it. But I think the broader point is that, you know, an old democracy, you know, I don't think we should junk the Constitution. I mean, we certainly argue that we need to, there's certain key elements of it that are really important to continue to embrace, but we need to continue to work to make it more democratic.
Daniel Ziblatt, professor of government at Harvard University and co-author of the new book with Stephen Levitsky called Tyranny of the Minority, Why American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thanks so much.
We'll talk to an expert at Stanford who's alarmed at California's proposals to change the way math is taught. That conversation is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. High school math. For people headed to college, it usually means Algebra 1 and 2, geometry, and maybe if you're lucky, some calculus. But imagine life without 8th grade algebra. That is in the new California Mathematics Framework. In a 1,000-page proposal, California plans to reshape math instruction as we currently know it, focusing on the needs of the individual student instead of requiring each child to follow the same track. But at least one math professor sees problems with this entire proposal, problems that could result in long-term deficiencies in math. Joining us now is that professor, Brian Conrad. He teaches at Stanford, and he recently wrote about his concerns with the California Mathematics Framework in an Atlantic essay. It's called California's Math Misadventure is About to Go National. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
All right. Well, first, let's talk about this California Mathematics Framework. Who is behind it, and why is there this idea that the way we teach math needs to change?
Well, the framework is written roughly every 7 or 8 years, and it gives guidance to districts on how to implement the content standards that are supposed to be learned year by year. The content standards haven't been changed, but the people behind it is the State Board of Ed, hires a variety of people from K-12 and other discipline experts to provide guidance to districts on how to teach to the content standards. And there are a lot of concerns due to the fact that the performance of students in math in California has been pretty dismal in the past years. And so there were suggestions on ways to try to address this.
So the idea is that if you teach differently, you will improve the outcome?
Again, there are a lot of differences between elementary grades and high school. But one of the driving goals was to try to suggest more engaging ways to teach, which I think everybody agrees would be wonderful, but also is suggestions about alternative content to be teaching and or blocking acceleration at certain stages under some claims that it will still help everybody and not hold anybody back. But the experience of San Francisco shows that blocking everyone from 8th grade Algebra 1 does not achieve the so-called equity claims that the people behind it were promising.
And the San Francisco model is what this is based on?
In the first draft, there was a lot of reference to what San Francisco had done for blocking 8th grade Algebra 1. And then there was a lot of outcry about that. And so the mention of San Francisco was removed. But this general idea that one should encourage a common pathway through grade 10 still shows up in the document. In some places, it says offering Algebra 1 in 8th grade is a good thing to do, but there are other places where it says the opposite, and that allows a district to point to their preferred place and say, ah, the state is giving us recommendations to do this.
Okay, can you back up for just a second and explain this controversy over 8th grade Algebra 1? Why do some people think that it's a bad idea?
So there are certainly serious demographic disparities in the success outcomes in more advanced mathematics in high school. And there are concerns that if you allow eighth grade algebra one, then kids who don't get, which tends to involve some acceleration, perhaps in seventh grade, then kids who don't get identified early on as being, you know, on the road towards more advanced math, don't have an opportunity to get there. And so rather than try to come up with multiple on-ramps for students to achieve those goals, if their interests evolve, the idea is to simply block everyone and then propose a variety of fantasies for how people can still reach calculus by the end of high school if they're interested.
You see it as lowering the standard for everybody because some people couldn't keep up?
Yeah. So what happens, let's take the case of San Francisco, which has implemented this for 10 years, but did recently acknowledge it was a complete failure. They simply said, we're not going to offer it in eighth grade. A lot of people left the district, went to private schools, or students had to do a wide array of workarounds, summer classes, compression courses, and so on. And it just created a lot more stress on the students rather than just simply offering multiple on-ramps or coming up with ideas for that. It just forced a lot of complicated Rube Goldberg type systems to try to still achieve the same end goal in terms of math knowledge. But the claims that it would improve the demographics and the outcomes was a complete bust.
Mm. Okay, so that's just one example, is this idea of getting rid of Algebra 1 in eighth grade. What are some other problems you have? And just to note, this is a 1,000-page framework. You submitted a 170 pages worth of documentation about the flaws in this.
Yeah, many of the concerns that I raised and that other people raised were addressed in the final draft, though other concerns did remain. One of the ones that remains is a certain amount of, I would say, hype and misinformation about data science. So it's very reasonable that the math curriculum needs to be taught in an engaging way. There certainly need to be sources of good motivation for why kids are learning things, and putting statistical topics into the curriculum is a very worthwhile thing to do. But the advocacy that still is present in parts of the document is this idea that rather than learning the usual math that's been taught in past decades, which is in fact the math you need for quantitative college degrees, people should be taught data science. And regardless of what data science means, the important point is there are no content standards for this, and there was no clear definition. And the courses that are most popular in this are very light on math. So students who follow that advice and take these alternative courses, if they go to college, will be very far behind.
Can you give me an example of what kinds of classes they're substituting for data science?
The typical one is what's called Algebra 2. And admittedly, the course called Algebra 2, whatever its variety of content it may have, may often be taught in a way that is perhaps dry or unmotivated. And the need to improve that motivation or improve the awareness of how it's relevant to many interesting modern applications is not addressed by simply recommending students to take alternative classes whose math content is extremely light. Even the people who run the data science programs at Stanford, at Berkeley, at various UCs have called this out as a very serious problem. People are being told that they'll be on the track to these really exciting careers if they choose these courses. But in fact, it's a false promise.
And what kinds of careers?
Being told that, for example, they can become a data scientist.
Uh-huh.
But the people who are getting those secure jobs have the four-year degrees in data science. But that requires learning calculus very early in college or in high school. But if you don't learn Algebra 2 in high school, it's extraordinarily difficult to do this as a four-year college degree.
Right. And you have to have Algebra 1. And if you have Algebra 1 in eighth grade, then that sets you on a path to eventually take calculus.
But to be fair, even if you don't have calculus in high school, if you go on the usual Algebra 1 in ninth grade, geometry, Algebra 2, and pre-calculus, you can start calculus in college. I mean, it's still within reach. But the advice to veer off after 10th grade into these other options, and the claims that this will not cut you off from degrees in economics, other STEM fields, data science, and so on, is simply not true. And this is what the letters from the experts in data science and other quantitative fields across the California universities called out in an open letter.
Mm. So what do you say to people who say, well, this is all good for people who want to enter STEM, but what about other people who aren't interested in STEM?
Well, that's a very fair point. And I think it's a reasonable debate to have as to at what point in one's education should you have to make an irreversible fork in the road choice that you are or are not going to allow yourself the option to pursue certain kinds of degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And in the U.S. system, it's often been the case that we try to delay that as much as possible, perhaps till early college, because some kids, their interests may evolve. You know, somebody may love video games and not realize that trigonometry and other parts of math lurk behind the design of video games, for example. And so that's kind of where the, I would say, the debate is located. In other countries, in Europe, students really do have to make a choice in some countries, the choice in the middle of high school. But particularly in view of the socioeconomic disparities in the public school systems in the US, it's often felt that we should try to allow kids to keep all options open. You're perfectly correct that somebody could say, I know at the end of 10th grade that I'm never going to go into anything quantitative, so I shouldn't have to take Algebra 2. And that's perfectly fine. And I'm not saying that Algebra 2 has to be a high school graduation requirement. And certainly providing other courses, statistical courses and so on, is a perfectly good thing. And if people want to take those, they can. But they should not be fed the false promise that by not learning certain core content in high school, that you will still have all options open in college.
Hmm. What other things do you have a problem with aside from the Algebra 2 that we've been talking about?
The primary concerns are exactly the two that we were discussing. Okay. But other ones, for example, would be that a lot of the root causes of the disparities really go back to the elementary grades. And the California Math Framework has no real suggestions on how to improve the math instruction in the elementary grades, whether it's a matter of improving the teacher training or perhaps putting some math specialists into the elementary schools. There's really no discussion of that. So that's a place where it was a letdown. Another one is the chapter on recommending textbooks for state adoption, which is necessary in grades K through 8, gave no advice to publishers on the fact that they need to dramatically improve the motivation for the material that the kids are learning. This was complete silence within the document. And I think that was another huge lost opportunity.
The title of your Atlantic essay is California's Math Misadventure is About to Go National. How is this going to go national?
For example, in Ohio, they've rolled out, this has been going on for a few years now, so-called computer science pathway and data science pathway alternatives in high school math past the second year. But the fine print of these descriptions points out that these are not for students whose careers will involve calculus, which may sound like a minor point, except that college degrees in computer science and data science require calculus in an essential way early on. And so these pathways, which remove the Algebra 2 guidance, are in fact dead ends for somebody who plans to go into those fields. And so it's tremendous misinformation.
Wow.
And something similar is emerging now in Connecticut as well.
So your concerns were made to the powers that be. What was their reaction?
Well, as I said, they did fix a lot of the concerns. There was a proposed data science pathway, for example, that was completely eliminated in the final draft. But the version that was approved still is filled in various places with either hype or misinformation about data science or playing both sides of the fence about eighth grade Algebra 1. And whether this will be fixed in the true final version that goes to the districts remains to be seen. But nonetheless, as I said, these things have been popping up now in other places, mm-hmm. Ohio and Connecticut, and undoubtedly in other places. And it's a big concern because people can be easily misled that if they don't realize the role that math plays in career preparation and a variety of lucrative and secure job directions, they may think that these lightweight courses are in fact the path to those careers, whereas in fact they are not.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's Brian Conrad. He's a math professor at Stanford University, and you can read his essay about California's standards at The Atlantic. Coming up, your weekend movie reviews, including The New Exorcist.
They basically assemble an Avenger-style team of all these different religions to save these girls and pull these demons out of them.
Movie reviews next on Press Play. This is KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Time now for our weekly movie reviews. And now that it's October, well, it's officially scary movie season. And from the paranormal horrors of an exorcism to the everyday horror of just being a woman in a bar, there is no shortage of frights on offer this week. We have two movie critics to help us decide what to see and what to skip. Allison Wilmore is film critic for New York Magazine and Vulture. Hi, Allison.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. And Tim Grierson is senior U.S. critic for Screen International and the author of This Is How You Make a Movie. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Madeline.
Let us begin with The Exorcist Believer. It stars Leslie Odom Jr. as the father of a young girl who wanders off into the woods with a school friend. And then they both return 3 days later, having caught something a little more sinister than a cold.
You have some experience with possession.
Yes, more than I'd like.
I believe you can help get our girls back.
Exorcism is a ritual. Every culture, every religion, they all use different methods. It's going to take all of them.
Don't be scared.
We've met before.
Ooh, okay. Is that Ellen Burstyn, I hear, Tim?
That's her. That's her.
From
She's
the OG
back.
Exorcist.
From the OG, yes.
She's back and the devil's back.
They're both back. It's October. It's that time of year. I mean, this is directed by David Gordon Green, who brought back the Halloween movies a few years ago. And like those reboots, direct sequels, he is trying to create more of a realistic, sort of gimmick-free version of the original Exorcist. And you have two young girls who are possessed this time. And as that clip indicated, they basically assemble an Avenger-style team of all these different religions to save these girls and pull these demons out of them. And for me, the first half of this movie, I sort of liked what David Gordon Green was trying to do. He's going for a slow burn, very kind of stripped down, realistic exorcism movie, kind of what William Friedkin was trying to do with the 1973 original. It's well acted. It's got Leslie Odom Jr., like you said, also has Ann Dowd. It's got a good cast. My problem is that eventually, as the gears start to turn and eventually becomes an exorcism movie, you realize that we've had 50 years of exorcism films, not just all the Exorcist sequels and prequels, but so many other movies that have worked in this mode. And it's hard for this movie to do anything that is that original or that interesting. So for me, ultimately, the movie didn't work. And what's even more depressing is that apparently there are going to be two more sequels after this one, which I really, really am not interested in seeing.
Wow. Okay. So The Devil You Know. Allison, Universal paid $400 million for the rights to this franchise. Oh.
Yeah. You know, it's... The IP is still worth so much to all of these studios. Anything that might be familiar to audiences, they're still willing to shell out just exorbitant amounts of money. But it's hard for me to see, even for audiences that are so hungry for horror, it's hard for me to see how this is going to work out well for Universal. This film is just not very scary. You know, I think to Tim's points, that there's only so much you can kind of do before you end up, you know, in the room with the possessed. And mm-hmm. and it's tricky to make an exorcism frightening. And, you know, I don't think that David Gordon Green really pulls that off. And I think the biggest idea this film has is the attempts to kind of de-Catholicize, you know, the idea of the exorcist. But I mean, the Catholicism is like pretty baked into a lot of not just kind of the format of the films, but a lot of the fears they're playing on. And so the film kind of ends up in an odd point in trying to kind of open up the traditions that it's dealing with, while at the same time holding on to a lot of these ideas about guilt and punishment and you know, sin that, mm-hmm. that feel left over from the original. So it wasn't very successful for me.
Okay. The Exorcist Believer in wide release on Friday. Up next, we have Cat Person. This is an adaptation of the New Yorker short story by Kristen Rupenian that went viral during the Me Too movement. It's about a young woman who goes on a really bad date with an older man and then can't get rid of him. It stars Emilia Jones and cousin Greg from Succession, Nicholas Braun.
Why lie about having cats?
Because liking cats makes a guy seem non-threatening. Harmless. He's hiding something.
I need to keep someone away from me. You scared me.
People choose to be scared.
Allison, this seems like it's trying to be a horror movie or a thriller or something like that. Does it work? And how does it compare to the short story?
Yeah, you know, if you remember the short story, and I had like gone back and reread it before watching this movie, you know, the short story is mostly about the misunderstandings and the text versus real life, you know, kind of situation in this ill-fated relationship that just kind of ends on this incredibly sour note. And for whatever reason, the filmmakers decided that in adapting it to film, they were going to try and turn it into a thriller without really changing the kind of most of the major beats, at least until the ending. This movie, I think, is a kind of a fascinating disaster. It has an ending that I will not spoil, but we'll just say it is not, it keeps going past where the short story ends into a very dramatic conclusion that I just, like, my jaw was agape. I couldn't believe that that was a choice that they decided to make. It is a very big choice, so certainly credit to them on that front. But it's, I think it just doesn't, the movie just doesn't capture so much of the stuff that made the short story resonate with people so much, at which point you kind of wonder, why do you need to adapt it in the first place?
Exactly. Go read the short story, and that'll be your Friday night. Tim, what did you think of Catperson?
Well, the short story is definitely better than the film. I've been defending this movie slightly since Sundance when it premiered, so I will do my best to defend it again. The ending is not good, as Allison pointed out. The ending is a mistake and pushes too far and doesn't work. One of the other big problems with the movie is it kind of tries to literalize stuff that worked better in the short story. The thing, though, that I liked about the film and thought that made it ultimately work despite several missteps along the way is I think Emilia Jones and Nicholas Braun are quite good as this possible couple. The movie opens with the famous Margaret Atwood quote about men are afraid that women are going to make fun of them and women are afraid that men are going to kill them. And that's essentially the thesis that the movie follows. And so while it is in some ways a thriller, it's also a movie about sort of what's going on inside Margot's head in terms of she thinks that this Robert guy, played by Nicholas Braun, he seems sweet, he seems harmless. They start to hang out, they start to text. He seems okay, but there's so many signals in the culture where, like, you can't trust guys, you got to be careful around guys. And so that starts to fill her head, but also just because she's in college and she's fearful, like, walking across campus at night, she knows that the world is filled with scary, bad men. And so she doesn't know how to take Robert. And I think Nicholas Braun does a good job in the film of playing a guy who might just be super awkward. He's a big film guy. He loves talking about Harrison Ford movies. And
well, that should have been her first warning to run away.
I think Nicholas Braun does this really good job of kind of walking the line between, is he a typical, like, film bro, over-explainer, mansplainer type of guy, which is one type of bad guy, or is there something more sinister about him?
Catperson in wide release on Friday. From one sinister older man to a bar full of them. Next up, we have The Royal Hotel. It's written and directed by Australian filmmaker Kitty Green. It stars Julia Garner and Jessica Henwick as two American backpackers in Australia who run out of money and then take a job at a remote bar in the outback.
We're on vacation. We should be on a beach somewhere.
We have sunshine and booze in a box.
Let's put up with it for a few weeks. Make some cash. It'll toughen us up.
Right. Gold is for Carl Gold. Red is Redland.
Honey's in his hand.
You get him a beer.
Why do you want to come all the way out here?
It was the furthest away.
Tim, this film was inspired by a 2016 documentary called Hotel Coolgardie about two women from Finland who did basically the same thing. What did you think?
If you see one movie this weekend about women in peril, this is the one, not Catperson. This is the new film from Kitty Green. She's a filmmaker who worked with Julia Garner before this film on her previous film, The Assistant. She also made a documentary called Casting John Benet. What Kitty Green is interested in as a filmmaker.
Oh, I love that documentary.
I'm a huge fan. It's still my favorite of all of her movies. And what Kitty Green does is she is interested in women not feeling safe in like public spaces, essentially. And that's what she sort of analyzes in her films. And that's just the case in The Royal Hotel as well. Julia Garner and Jessica Henwick play these backpackers that go to the outback. They start working at this bar where they're essentially just sexually harassed day and night. And all the older male, you know, customers are like, oh, you know, we're just playing around. We're just having fun. You should smile more, lighten up. The film is filled with all of these just sort of microaggressions and this like constant gaslighting of, oh, you girls, you're worrying too much. We're harmless. But Hannah and Liv, the two characters that Julia Garner and Jessica Henwick play, feel more and more uncomfortable. And Hannah, Julia Garner's character, feels more and more increasingly uncomfortable and wants to leave. And for reasons I think are very interesting and not explained, Liv isn't enjoying it necessarily, but she's like, we can tough it out. We can hang out. We can do this. There's a little bit of a fracture in their friendship as this movie goes along. And it builds to this conclusion that I don't know if it entirely works, but it feels like a logical extension of the tension and the microaggressions and this feeling of, is something going to happen? Something finally happens at the end of the movie. I don't know if it's entirely well executed, but regardless, I think this film is really sharp, really smart. Both of those performances are really good. Hugo Weaving as the guy who's very permissive, who runs the bar and tells them not to worry so much. He's also very good at being just a horrible, loathsome human being.
Allison, it sounds like this movie is achieving what Cat Person tried to do and failed.
Yeah, it's very funny to talk about this immediately after Cat Person, because the both films try and contend with so much of the same thing, which is, you know, being a woman in an environment where you don't feel safe, you don't feel comfortable. But also, I think being a woman and trying to parse all of the different conflicting signals that you're getting to try and understand if you are going to be safe. You know, I think one thing that this film like does so well are show all of the little calibrations that these characters constantly have to make, all of the kind of like, you know, the adjustments that they're making in their head to, you know, be friendly, you know, look friendly to men who are at the bar, but also like keep them at a distance close enough so they don't get the wrong idea. Tim, it did tickle me a bit that you were wondering why Liv, Jessica Henwick's character, wanted to stay. I do feel like if you have ever been the kind of, you know, the responsible friend with a party friend, like, you know, if you've ever been the responsible friend who has like had a friend that you've had to kind of always constantly like make sure they're not getting in trouble and make sure they get home safe, I think that relationship will make total sense to you. I think it's a very good depiction of that dynamic. I do wish there had been a little more done with it, particularly towards the climax of the film. But I think, in particular, Julia Garner, who was so good in The Assistant as well, is just a great screen presence and is really good at just navigating this kind of difficult, you know, working relationship and friendship and all of these like little slights and little dramas she has to overcome. I think it's a great performance, and it's a movie that I think overall is quite good.
The Royal Hotel in wide release on Friday. Finally, a reprieve from the sinister October movies. We have a comedy called Dicks the Musical, based on an off-Broadway musical with a title we cannot say on the radio, by Aaron Jackson and Josh Sharp. They also star in the film, and it's a bawdy, R-rated spoof on The Parent Trap with a lot of song and dance.
The only thing I have from the dad I never knew is
half of a locket.
We must be brothers.
Not just brothers, Trevor.
Twins.
Wow, we're twins.
If mom and dad got married again, then we'd have a real family.
What if we trick them into getting back together?
What are you doing here?
The twins.
Okay, Allison, that's Nathan Lane, Megan Mullally, Megan Thee Stallion, Bowen Yang. A huge cast of big personalities. What do you think of the movie?
Well, as you may be able to tell just from the trailer, this is a movie that thrives on chaos. It has all sorts of stuff going on. In addition to the song and dance, you have, you know, Sharp and Jackson, who are two gay men, are playing these caricatures of hetero alpha males, you know, these like suit wearing, women chasing, line cutting jerks. You know, Nathan Lane and Megan Mullally are playing incredibly weird characters. And we haven't even gotten to the fact that one of them keeps these kind of mutants that he found in the sewer as pets and feeds them chewed up ham. As I guess, like, you know, they can't chew it themselves. There's all sorts of stuff going on in this movie. Too much to summarize. I think it's like really fun until it gets really tiring by the end. It's hard to maintain that sort, that level of just like manic energy and kind of like this really, you know, anarchic sense of humor. But there are definitely scenes in this movie I will never forget. And I did enjoy Megan Thee Stallion. She gets, yeah, she plays the boss at the office the two characters work at, and she gets a particularly memorable song that ends with her leading her male employees around by their ties as if they were leashes.
Ooh, okay. I sense some revenge in this whole theme here for the bad men theme of our film segment. Tim, what did you think? Too much of a muchness or?
Too much of a muchness was how I felt too. The first half, this movie was only about 85 minutes long, and the first half is such a blast. It's so funny. It's a musical, and I think the musical, the songs are better. They're stronger in the first half. The whole thing is just better in the first half. Like Allison, I think it runs out of gas before the ending. Unfortunately, I just think the songs aren't as good. It's just not as funny as the movie goes along. There are great bits and pieces, like Allison said, but I never saw the off Broadway show that this is based on. My understanding is that they expanded it to make it feature length. There is a part of me that wonders if the off Broadway show was tighter and more like jokes per minute that landed, whereas the film, it feels a little more protracted.
All right, Dicks, the musical is in wide release beginning Friday. A great note to end on. Tim Gerson is senior U.S. critic for Screen International and the author of This Is How You Make a Movie. And Allison Wilmore is film critic for New York Magazine and Vulture. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, it is Fat Bear Week. Yes. It's that time of year again. We'll handicap your brackets next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Even though it doesn't feel like it today, summer is officially over, and it's time to start preparing to hibernate. Far, far away from LA, the brown bears of Alaska's Katmai National Park are doing just that. For months, these bears have been bulking up on sockeye salmon before they begin their dormant winter. It all culminates with the annual Fat Bear Week celebration, which began yesterday. The event was created nearly a decade ago by former park ranger Mike Fitz, who is now the resident naturalist with Explore.org and the author of the book, The Bears of Brooks Falls, Wildlife and Survival on Alaska's Brooks River. Welcome back to Press Play, Mike.
Happy Fat Bear Week.
Okay, so who are the contenders? Last year, 747 won, and he's a two-time winner. Who do you think could take his crown?
747's back in the competition this year, and he's still a giant of a bear. I'm not sure he's as large as last year, though. There's another bear on the river also in the Fat Bear Week bracket, number 32 Chunk, which actually has Chunk's been more dominant than 747 this year. And I think Chunk is one of the favorites maybe to win the competition. He's both of those bears are successful, dominant males, really big animals. So they can go to the waterfall and basically sit and wait for fish to come to them. And they don't really face much competition except for each other because they are so large. But there's female bears in the bracket as well that have done really well for themselves. Number 435 Holly, she's a past winner. She is really pudgy. She really is the shape and the color of a toasted marshmallow, as I like to call her. So, you know, she has a lot of fans. This year, I endorsed 128, who's nicknamed Grazer. She also is really fat, and she is like the archetypal mama bear. So she's an extremely tough, fierce, and defensive mother bear. This year, though, she's single. She doesn't have any cubs with her. She's separated from her cubs in the springtime. And she's done, again, really well for herself, fishing on the lip of the falls, fishing downstream in many places. I think she's the best angler on the river. I also can't count out a perennial favorite 480, who's nicknamed Otis. He is an older bear, and he showed up in late July extremely skinny. We could see his rib bones. We could see his hip bones. Oh. But he made up for lost time. I don't know what he was doing before he came to Brooks River, but he wasn't eating. But he's gained a significant amount of weight in the past couple of months, and he has a large following. He's extremely patient and skilled and knowledgeable about the river. So a lot of people admire him, and he's an older bear that's overcome a lot of challenges.
Oh, props to the older bear. So what are we voting on? Are we voting on sheer girth? Are we voting on tenacity? Are we voting on the coat that we like the best?
Well, it could be all of the above. If somebody wanted to vote just based on sheer size alone, you could do that. You could think about the percentage of body mass that they're gaining each year. You know, a bear like Chunk and 747, they get a lot of attention because they're so large. But as a percentage of their body mass, smaller bears actually gain more every year than a big bear like 747. So a spring cub, for instance, starts life in the den at 1 pound. And then by this time of the year, it could easily weigh 70 pounds. So yeah, who knows? I don't know if people are going to go through girth or body mass gain overall, or consider, we also hope that people consider the stories of the bears as well, because each one of them is an individual that lives and survives sort of in its own way. And each one of them allows us to celebrate the success of the bears and Katmai National Park's healthy ecosystem.
And so for people who don't know, who have not heard of Fat Bear Week, they can go to explore.org, watch live cams, live feeds of the bears actually in the river eating or doing what they're doing, and then they can cast their votes on their for their favorite. And it's a bracket situation like March Madness, but it's bear madness. So I understand that the salmon run is a little thinner this year. Is that right? And are the bears then also thinner?
Yeah, we experienced a different salmon run this year compared to the last few years. Like going back to like 2019 forward, the salmon runs in the Bristol Bay area and at Brooks River, they were just bonkers. Like in 2020, we had more salmon moved through Brooks River than anybody had ever seen before. The bears were essentially released from food competition. They didn't have to compete for fishing spots because there were so many fish everywhere. In contrast, this year, the salmon run was a bit more average, but I think really the real difference was that the salmon run came later than expected in Brooks River. We're not sure why. Salmon were still coming into the Bristol Bay area as they normally would. They just didn't show up in Brooks River like we expected in early July. So many bears lost, I think, 2 to 3 weeks of fishing opportunity for them. That's especially hard for mother bears raising cubs because they not only have to feed themselves, but they have to make sure that their cubs are safe and their cubs are well fed. Throughout late summer, plenty of salmon available to the bears. The timing of it this year was quite different. But overall in Bristol Bay, it was another really successful year for salmon with more than 50 million sockeye salmon returning to the region.
So this is actually, I mean, it's a lot of fun, but this is actually an educational event. You want people to go online and check them out and learn a little bit about what's happening up there in Alaska.
Absolutely. We encourage people to get to know the bears at Brooks River individually because we have that opportunity to do that through the webcams. We can watch them across seasons and years, get to know their different dispositions and personalities and how they survive. Fat Bear Week allows us to, again, celebrate the success of each one of these bears. And we really do hope that people consider the different stories of the individuals, because the story of Otis is very different this year compared to a bear like Chunk. It's very different compared to number 901, who's in another matchup tomorrow, and she's raising right now 2 spring cubs. So yeah, you can think about when you're voting, you can think about girth, you can think about body size, but also, yeah, we want people to celebrate the individual bears and then think about their food as well. What is supporting the bears at Brooks River? That's the sockeye salmon. And there would be no Fat Bear Week without healthy oceans supporting, you know, salmon for 2 to 3 years, healthy freshwater watersheds supporting the juvenile sockeye salmon for 1 to 2 years. The salmon really are the unsung heroes of Fat Bear Week.
All right. Mike Fitz, also a hero of Fat Bear Week, former park ranger at Katmai National Park in Alaska and resident naturalist at explore.org, where you can go to watch live feeds of the bears and cast your votes. Mike, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, our fat bears are Brian Hartzinski, Angie Perrin, Robin Estrin, Sarah Schiff, and Bennett Purser. Michelle Aloy is our line editor, Amy Ta, our digital editor, Sarah Sweeney, our managing producer, our technical director is Mario Saavedra, Jay Siebold, and Sue Margulies, also engineered this week. Tune in right here tomorrow for KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. We'll talk about all the shenanigans that went down this week in the House of Representatives with the experts. So stay here at noon and 7, KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. Don't forget to follow us on the socials, by the way. We're at KCRW. I'm at The Mad Brand. Thanks for listening today. Have a fantastic weekend, and I'll see you on Monday.